You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is David Rovics and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network. I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the people of the Woorong and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nations on whose unceded lands the 3CR studios stand, respectfully acknowledging their ancestors and elders, past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional custodians and the ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia where our broadcast reaches. We acknowledge that there will be no climate justice without First Nations justice. Whether you're listening on the 855am dial, on Radio Skid Row or on the Community Radio app, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Climate Action Show. My name is Shay and I'm your host for today. We've got a pretty packed show today, so I'll get straight into it. Joining me on the line now is Gavin, the Climate and Energy Program Manager at the Australian Conservation Foundation. Gavin, welcome back to the Climate Action Show and thanks so much for coming on.
Great to be here.
Last time you were on the show, I think it was about a month ago now, we talked a lot about Woodside Energy's Browse Gas Project. Have there been any more developments on that?
Yeah, there have. So for your listeners, those who weren't listening to the segment a month ago, Woodside's Browse gas proposal is a proposal for a huge new gas development on a currently unexploited field about 300 kilometres offshore off the West Australian Northwest Shelf coast, so like 300k off the coast from, say, Broome, for example. And it's a proposal to drill over 50 wells adjacent to one of the most pristine reef ecosystems left in the world called Scott Reef. And the proposal is to drill those wells and extract huge amounts of gas, almost entirely for export. That gas will produce about 1.6 billion tonnes of emissions. It's absolutely huge in terms of its climate impact. A climate impact so great that we can actually track its impact globally. So we can attribute the impact of those emissions on, say, coral death on the Great Barrier Reef on the other side of the country. It's about four times Australia's annual emissions, and we think that if it goes ahead, Australia won't be able to meet its future climate targets. So it's a huge project. It also has huge natural values impacts. Drilling wells adjacent to this reef ecosystem that was part of an ecosystem, a Great Barrier Reef that actually traversed the west coast of Australia, and there's a whole range of endangered and rare species there, like the pygmy blue whale and a genetically diverse species of green turtle. So we're extremely concerned about this project. It's a red line for groups like ACF and Greenpeace and faces an upcoming both Western Australian government and federal approval towards the end of this year into early next year. So we're continuing to campaign with Greenpeace on this project, pushing federal decision makers, in particular Environment Minister Murray Watt, who needs to make an approval or rejection of this project late this year or early next year. So the push is on to make sure this project doesn't go ahead. And if people want to know more, and even better to get involved in this campaign, please go to the ACF website to find out more.
Yeah, and I think last time we spoke as well, there was sort of a push for the government. I think there was something coming up with a government decision about it. Has anything developed in that way, or are we still sort of waiting on that to happen?
Still waiting on that to happen. We thought that the WA Environmental Protection Agency, which needs to make a recommendation on this project to the WA government, it was due to make its decision in August. So that's what we would have been talking about. That seems to now be pushed back. It won't be in the coming days, but it will be in the coming months. So we're obviously waiting with bated breath for that. But to be honest, we're really relying on the federal government to reject this project. The WA government is closely attached to the gas industry and will be difficult to move, not impossible, but difficult. So we're really engaging the federal government to hold this issue in the national interest, in the interest of climate and nature protection, and reject this proposal when it comes before their desk by early next year.
Yeah, and how's the momentum going on that? So what do you think is sort of the likelihood of that happening, and how's the campaigning going so far?
So the campaign's really cranking up. So people, both in Perth, but now increasingly in East Coast capitals, Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane, will see a big increase in in ACF and Greenpeace publicising that campaign, lifting public awareness about it, and proposing ways that people can get more involved. And that can be as little as signing a petition or a submission to government, or getting involved in some of our public events. And if you go to the website, you'll find out what are the events that you can get involved in close to where you live.
Yeah, and I notice as well the government has opened up public consultation with Browse, and it says on your website that's the first time in 8 years. It's a little bit of a random question, but it kind of relates to what we've got coming up on the show later on. But have you noticed sort of any astroturfing going on with this, sort of with other groups and projects like this happening? Or
when you say astroturfing, what do you mean?
So sort of like, yeah, it might have been a question for after. We've got a bit of a segment on astroturfing coming up, but it's sort of like when organised corporate, like financial groups, they organise a political campaign made to look quite natural and spontaneous, as if it's coming from everyday people. So it's kind of like this fabricating of public opinion to be for or against it. So I was wondering if you've noticed anything cropping up that's looking like a bit random, that people are against this, are for the Woodside Browse Gas project, that looks a little bit suspicious. Is anything like that happening?
Not so much on Browse. I mean, what we're seeing is that the federal government does talk out both sides of their mouth on its climate credentials. So this federal government, and in particular Climate Minister Bowen, we think it's actually done overall quite a good job when it comes to domestic transition of our energy system, so getting us off coal and gas domestically and onto more renewable energy. People might have seen, for example, just recently the federal government's program to install home batteries around the country has crossed 500,000. So 500,000 households now have or are about to have home batteries, which will again improve the stability of our energy grid and allow us to get off coal and gas faster. But what the federal government's not doing is anything about our coal and gas exports. So it's doing an okay job domestically, but it's absolutely letting rip when it comes to projects destined for export. And of course, as we know, it doesn't matter where Australian coal and gas is burnt, whether it's here or in Tokyo or Beijing or Seoul, the impacts on our climate here at home are the same. So it's not really astroturfing, but the federal government really talks up its domestic performance on climate action and washes its hands of its coal and gas exports. And that's what Browse is, for example. And people might have heard of another huge gas proposal on the horizon called Beetaloo. It's a fracking proposal in the NT, again, overwhelmingly destined for export. So what we're critical of the government is that while they're doing quite a good job domestically, they're absolutely washing their hands of the emissions that we export when we export our coal and gas to the world. And that's why we're so focused on projects like Browse and soon to come Beetaloo, because the vast bulk of Australia's emissions that we're responsible for are now exported. About 75% of our emissions are exported. And so we need to not only have a domestic energy transition, but we need to transition our exports as well. We still think Australia can become or be a energy export superpower, but we want it in green industries like green steel, green aluminium, critical minerals and so forth, so that we can phase out of coal and gas for export, just like we're on the way to doing domestically.
Yeah, and like you said, it's the impact that matters. It's still going to have the same impact on our environment. With Beetaloo, will that be a similar situation with how the government sort of opening up the public consultation on it, similar to Woodside, or?
Yeah, the process will have some similarities. So there will still need to be a federal and series of territory approvals. Again, This is an area where the NT government is exceptionally pro-gas, the Conservative government there, and so we're going to need federal intervention to stop Beetaloo going ahead. It's a bit different in that Browse is an offshore gas project. This is fracking onshore, obviously, in the NT, in a currently unexploited field called Beetaloo, about 500k sort of southeast of Darwin, and they're proposing to frack the gas out of the Beetaloo, which has really significant natural values impacts and also big cultural impacts. So a number of traditional owners are exceptionally concerned about the impact this fracking will have on their song lines and their water system, especially underground water, and that will be the subject of federal approval as well. So that campaign's been going for a while, but the first exploratory gas is due to be fracked out of the Beetaloo in September, and if that goes well for the company, if they find a lot of gas, they'll make a much bigger proposal for commercial fracking in that region, and that will trigger the kind of federal approvals sort of similar to the Browse project, and will again be the subject of a big campaign by ACF that will be inviting the public from around Australia to call for that not to go ahead.
Yeah, and what can the public do in that regard?
We'll be in touch with people on Beetaloo. Again, go to the website to find acf.org.au website to find out more about what you can do on Beetaloo. Beetaloo's a bit further down the track, so we're really focused on Browse at the moment, knock that off, and then we will turn our heavy campaign attention to Beetaloo. But we're still working on Beetaloo behind the scenes and getting that campaign right, working with traditional owners, other environment groups, and getting into a position where we can run a really good campaign on Beetaloo. But go to the website again to find out more.
Yeah, one thing at a time. And last time we spoke as well, we sort of talked a little bit about data centres. I want to know if there's anything you'd like to add, any updates about that?
Yeah, so the federal government has, and we've largely welcomed this, is a good move overwhelmingly. Minister Bowen, the federal climate minister, announced that if data centres are to go ahead, those data centres need to provide their own renewable energy. So not even drawing renewable energy out of the grid, they will need to be responsible for buying new renewable energy capacity so that that renewable energy is still available to households and to get our emissions down. So companies who want to do data centres are going to have to find agreements and strike contracts to access their own renewable energy. And the federal government's also placed some restrictions on water use because data centres use a hell of a lot of water as well. So we think that's been a welcome move. The states are due to agree on that federal government proposal on Wednesday. All the states are agreeing to it apart from Queensland and the NT. And the federal government's actually decided that it will override Queensland and the NT and enforce this federally, which we believe is a good outcome. Otherwise, in the NT and in Queensland, data centres will be able to use coal or gas, or will be able to access renewable energy for the grid, which will mean less renewable energy for everybody else and will push up energy prices, which we know in a cost of living crisis isn't the way to go. So those data centres are going to have to find a sustainable way to access water, and they're going to have to produce their own renewable energy in order for those data centres to go ahead.
That's good to hear. Where are the majority of these data centres already, or where are they proposed? Are they proposed in Queensland and the NT?
There's dozens of proposals throughout the country, mostly in and around the big population centres, so less than at the NT at the moment, although there is speculation that if Beetaloo gas is fracked, that it will be used to power data centres of the NT, and that's what we're concerned about. But at the moment, there are dozens of data centre proposals around the country. Like, this is a rapidly moving space and a big increase in data centre development across the eastern seaboard. So, I mean, I've mentioned the climate and environmental impacts, but obviously there are other community concerns that people have about data centres being built in and around where they live, which will be controversial at a local community level amongst some communities who will be concerned about data centres being built in their neighbourhoods. And we've seen campaigns already emerging in Australia to oppose some of those data centres, and we've seen big campaigns in places like the United States where data centres have been built already and have faced big community backlash. So the social licence for data centres is still something that will need to be worked on if they're to go ahead with community support.
Mm-hmm. And you said the Beedaloo fracking that will potentially go to a data centre. Is there a lot of kind of ties between fossil fuel gas companies and these data centres being proposed?
I'm not sure that there's clear direct links, but clearly those data centres want to go ahead with the cheapest form of energy they can. Now, that's renewables, but they would prefer probably not to build their own and just access the energy grid that everyone else accesses. But because they use so much energy, that's why we think the federal government's made the right move to requiring those data centres to access their own renewable energy. So they're going to have to go ahead and strike deals with renewable energy companies to build and access the renewable energy that they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. And is there anything else, any updates you wanted to share as well, just in the final few minutes?
I mean, they're the really big ones. As people know, we're also heading towards COP, which are the big annual global negotiations on climate change. They happen in November each year. It's what people would describe as the Paris Agreement, because a critical COP was in Paris in 2016. And this COP's a bit different, because while it's in Turkey, Australia is co-host of that COP. We are the climate minister, Chris Bowen, is the lead negotiator for that COP. So in the coming weeks and months, you'll see a lot more news about the role Australia's playing in co-hosting a COP to negotiate stronger climate action for the globe. And so look out for more news stories about that, particularly as the pre-COP, there's a big pre-meeting in the Pacific that Australia will co-host. And, of course, Pacific Island nations are the most vulnerable when it comes to climate change impacts. Countries are literally going underwater as sea levels rise. So there'll be a lot of attention on Australia's performance in trying to navigate a successful international meeting to strike more ambitious agreements to transition away from fossil fuels towards renewables moving forward.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Gavin. And we'll speak to you again in a month, I think.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. You're tuned into the Climate Action Show on 3CR 855 AM. Next up, we have an interview from the Climate Action Show's Rosie, who spoke to Tim from the Smart Energy Council last week.
Speaking with us over the phone today is Tim Lammercraft. Tim was a journalist, but is now head of media and communications at Smart Energy Council, which is Australia's peak body for renewable energy, energy storage and clean technology. Hi, Tim, and welcome to the Climate Action Show. Thanks very much for joining us today, especially at short notice.
Rosie, absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. Now, as you know, we had Jeremy Walker on the show last week talking about the recent Senate inquiry into climate disinformation. Thanks to that inquiry, details of the nature, extent and origins of climate disinformation are now on the public record. But how many people actually access this information or even know it exists? It got very limited mainstream media coverage, which unfortunately is not surprising. Now, I know this is a topic close to your heart, Tim, and we're very interested to hear your perspectives, both personal and in your role with the Smart Energy Council. So can you start off by telling us a bit about yourself and how you came to be so passionate about exposing the ever-growing dense network of AstroTurf groups?
Sure. And look, it's probably just useful for your listeners to know, energy is an incredibly complex area of public policy and engineering. And so I apologise in advance if I use any acronyms or I take you down any rabbit holes, because there are plenty. But it's also useful to know who the Smart Energy Council is. As you said, we're one of Australia's peak industry bodies for the renewables industry. Last year celebrated our 70th anniversary, which probably makes us the oldest, and if not one of the oldest renewable energy industry groups in the world, spun out of a bunch of early CSIRO pioneers who believed that we should be harnessing the sun and using it to power things, including hot water at the time was their early sort of genesis of our movement. So that's just how long renewables have been around and we've been harnessing the sun. The reason why I found myself here is after decades in journalism and travelling the country, working for the ABC and periods at Fairfax and also with the project for several years, I spent a lot of time, including my university education, in places like the Latrobe Valley in Victoria and the Hunter and the Upper Hunter in New South Wales, which are the big resource regions and the energy generation regions, largely coal mining, coal-fired generators, gas extraction, you name it, those regions are absolutely typified by it. And, you know, the thing that I often talk about when living in the Latrobe Valley is I used to live just up on the gentle hills up behind Hazelwood Power Station, and I used to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning when Hazelwood would start switching on, as I said, when they used to kick the old girl in the guts because she was so old and clapped out, it'd take about 3 years for her to get up to actual full generation capacity because it was just such an old coal-fired power station. And it really was my first foray into thinking about energy, how it functions, the impact it has on landscapes, and, you know, also with that, all the emissions that go with it, the impacts on the environment. And, you know, I sort of had this sort of juncture in my life of thinking, you know, I've always wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a photojournalist. I was there studying university, studying journalism. But I found myself increasingly trying to report on what was the campaign at the time to shut Hazelwood down because it was expanding, it was encroaching on farmland because they were running out of coal and that coal lay beneath farming properties. And, you know, I was interviewing a lot of those farmers at the time, a lot of them third-generation farmers, been there for a long time, and they were literally facing mandatory acquisition to have their properties dug up and the brown coal beneath, which, let's be honest, brown coal is, you know, it's fossils, it's dinosaurs. We are burning dinosaurs to generate power in the coal industry. And it made me just realise the absolute impact on agriculture, on place, on space, and it has a real impact. And it's not until you really spend time in those communities that you get the first-hand understanding. You see the pollution, you smell the pollution, you inhale the pollution, but more than that, it has an enormous scar on the landscape. It consumes water, it digs vast holes in the ground, holes in the ground that we still don't know what to do with. We still have no idea what we're going to do with the Hazelwood mine pit. You know, we all know what can happen with the Hazelwood mine pit and others in Lac-Yulon after the Hazelwood mine fire, which burnt for 40-plus days.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so, that was my introduction, Rosie, to really understanding energy quite a bit more and really getting into it and having to think about it. And that was kind of my foray into energy.
Mm-hmm. And what about your family? Did they have the same feelings as you about it? And also, how old were you when you sort of came to this realisation?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, my father, my mother's British. She moved out here in the 70s and met my father and never went home. But my father was in agricultural machinery. Mm-hmm. I was born in very far west New South Wales in quite a large regional town out there, which is now, you know, hosting renewable energy zone, and so it's on its new journey there. But, you know, I used to go around to all the field days with my father, these agricultural machinery field days, the Dubbos, the Oranges, and the Hayes, and various others. So I felt like it was a really privileged upbringing in many ways because I got to see regional Australia, I got to understand regional Australia, I got to meet regional Australians, understand farming and understand agriculture and understand the land. So that was kind of my journey, my childhood, really. But, you know, so my father's always had quite a good understanding of the land and the need to care for it and farming practices. And so I was lucky enough to, you know, imbibe a lot of that from him. And, you know, I'd moved down to the valley in the Latrobe Valley in the early 2000s, which was just as the campaign to sort of start talking about Hazelwood's closure really started picking up. There was a Labor government in power at the time, and they were very reluctant to be shutting down a power station that employed so many people, despite the fact that Hazelwood was the dirtiest coal-fired power station in Australia and various other things. But that was when I was down there, so early 2000s, Rosie.
Yep, right.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Now, you've done a lot of research into AstroTurf groups, but before we go on with that, maybe would you mind explaining what astroturfing means for people who might not know?
Yeah, well, here's a little lovely factoid. AstroTurf, which we all know, which is fake grass, which is the plastic grass which we see on sporting fields and we have in our backyards when we can't be bothered mowing, AstroTurf or Chemgrass was invented by Monsanto in 1965, that very large chemical company and pharmaceutical company. So that's the neat little, origin story behind the name. But essentially it is exactly that. It's fake green. It's when you pretend something is, green when it's usually not. It is basically creating a fake public movement, seen to be grassroots, when in fact it's actually got bad faith actors trying to push their own agenda in the background. And typically we associate this with big fossil fuel companies and big fossil fuel operators, whether that's oil, coal, gas, even nuclear these days. So that's basically what astroturfing is.
Mm-hmm. And what have you come to learn over recent years about how these groups work, who's behind them, and what effect they have?
Well, I think, as a broad context, it's really important to think about this, Rosie, which is, power is never ceded easily. And the power, as we've known it, both in energy generation, but in political power and economic power, has been residing with the big oil, the big coal, the big gas. Billions and billions of dollars has been made. Governments have been toppled in the name of maintaining profits and proceeds and access to the resources there. And they don't want to cede that power, that economic income stream willingly. And they will do pretty much anything they can to maintain that power. And what we now start seeing that form in, and, I'll do the shout-out to the people who really deserve it. There's, journalists like Royce Kermelovs and his book Slick, Australia's Toxic Obsession with Oil and Gas, who've gone back and found, the genesis, the roots, the early stages of how these big fossil companies, the oil and gas companies, have gone about setting up AstroTurf groups, fake movements, fake organisations, fake think tanks, in order to influence and sway public opinion, to provide pseudo-research, to counter universities and academics and public policy people who are doing the hard work, in order to try and delay or distract. And, that kind of, in the modern parlance and the modern examples that we think of, this is the Institute of Public Affairs, this is the Centre of Independent Studies, these think tanks that now are still very prominent, in Australian media circles. They still get invited on to radio and TV and, in print to come and espouse their views and you know, present as some sort of, objective thought leader. But not only that, Rosie, is that what we're now seeing is that they've been around such a long time and they've got such a pernicious influence and history over Australian policy and debate and culture that they're now reaching some of the highest echelons of politics. You know, for example, Senator James Patterson in Victoria, the Liberal senator, Tim Wilson, who is probably a prominent name in for your listeners.
Absolutely,
there.
Absolutely, yep.
They're all ex-IPA. They're all ex-center of the IPA, Institute of Public Affairs, and at a state level we have Evan Mulholland. This organisation has basically done its best, having originally been set up by fossil fuel money and industry at the top of Collins Street there, where the intersection of big mining and big resources, and they've spent decades of delay and overturning, public policy on climate action, on switching out polluting fossils, and policy towards renewables. And it's these things that, having been a political reporter and having been a journalist and starting to sort of pull these threads together, when you start thinking, well, why are we having these ridiculous policy debates? We know that we are cooking the planet. We know the planet is warming. We know that coal contributes massive amounts of CO2 into our atmosphere. We know it depletes water resources. And so a lot of it was frustration, Rosie, just trying to figure out, why are we having these same bloody arguments year after year, decade after decade? And so you sort of find yourself in the position I am now, Rosie, where, I'm trying to communicate explain to people that we're being hoodwinked.
And do you think that the politicians know and are just captured by big fossil fuel and the benefit it is for politicians to get cozy with big fossil fuel companies to help promote their career and stay in power? Do you think that the politicians actually are aware of what's going on and going along with it, or are they just being hoodwinked too?
I'm just thinking about how to be diplomatic about this. There's sort of two options here. Either they're ignorant or they're doing it on purpose, and neither is a good excuse. So let's even give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they're a little bit ignorant. If they are ignorant, then they probably shouldn't be in any position of power. And if they are doing it on purpose, which I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest exactly that, and we're talking about the revolving door of politics, where people walk out of politics straight into very lucrative jobs in gas and coal, and, we can go down the National Party hagiography of, where the former leaders of the Federal National Party have ended up in their current roles today, including heading up Whitehaven Coal or running Eastern Star Gas that went to be sold to Santos for the what's now known as Narrabri Gas Project, or others who have found themselves to be running some of the largest lobbying outfits for the biggest coal companies in the world. I mean, that's not being cynical. That's just being real.
Yeah. Now, I don't know.
One thing I'd like to say is this isn't just a distinct National Party issue either. We've seen the Labor Party former resources ministers go on to head up the main gas lobby in Australia. The path seems to be a little more well-worn and tread out of some of the Conservative parties, the Liberals and particularly the Nationals, but Labor has certainly got its luminaries who've gone on to take very lucrative and powerful positions with fossil fuel.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems to me that the only major political party that doesn't do this are the Greens. But nobody... talks much about the Greens in that regard. Why do you think that is?
Well, look, the Greens still maintain a very large chunk of the voting populace. You know, they hover around 12% at a national level, so the vote remains strong. And, I think they do still have quite an influence over policy and debate. And, I think the Greens are going through a bit of a reckoning of their own at the moment over the last few elections, as all political parties are. The Greens do maintain a powerful position in public policy and debate. I would suggest that they're not the only ones. You know, we are seeing the rise of the community independents, and the community independents traditionally with very strong climate and clean energy policy and views. And there is more than one political actor out there who can fly the flag and say that they're doing the right thing. But I think when it comes into some of the bigger parties, whether it's the Labors or the Liberals or the National parties, they're all going through something of a reckoning, but they've all got their climate champions and their energy champions. And, I think that's important to say. You know, as my years grow older and I start to see more shades of grey in the world, and I used to be far more righteous and black and white, and but there is good within every party, and right. I want to highlight that.
Yes, I think I'm still going through the righteous black and white stage. Maybe I should take your advice.
I oscillate.
What's that?
I oscillate.
Right. I was just going to ask, with your extensive journalism background, you've had a lot of experience communicating with the public. What do you think's the best way to get this information across to as many people as possible about astroturfing groups? Discern what information you're getting?
Well, it's also understanding how people consume information. So it's also sort of going back to brass tacks, really, which is, there's famous adages in marketing and communications, which is, until you've heard something 10 times, this is the advertising golden rule about, television advertising or marketing or jingles and things like that. Until you've heard something 10 times, it's not until the 11th time that you hear it for the first time. Mm-hmm. It's the vomit principle. So you need to say the same thing again and again and again and again and again and again until you feel sick, and then you say it again. And there are basic principles out there which we need to keep reminding people of, and things that people simply don't know about because they haven't heard it enough and they haven't heard the truth enough. And in this world of hyper-information and scrolling and multiple platforms and so many sources of information, you can forgive people for being drowned out in the noise. But there are some really important touchstones that we can go back to and remind people of. Simple things like solar power is incredibly successful and popular in Australia, not because people are hippies, but because it saves money. Mm. So there is 40% of Australian households with solar on their rooftops. That's 4.5 million Australian homes, 10 million Australian people with, the ABS average of 2.5 people per household. It's 10 million people who go to sleep with solar beneath solar panels every night in Australia. Solar is an amazing success story. We invented solar. If you, 9/10 of the IP, the intellectual property in any solar panel you pick up around the world, the IP that makes that actual solar panel function was designed in Australia. Yeah. We should be so proud of these things, and we should be saying it to people again and again and again that Australia punches above its weight. We literally invented the renewable energy source powered by the sun that has now, within next year or the year after, the International Energy Agency, the world's peak energy agency, expects that solar will be generating more power than the world's entire coal fleets combined. So these humble researchers in Australia that invented solar at the University of New South Wales and, you know, Australian National University went on to develop a power source generation that is already in Australia generating more power than all of our coal fleet combined.
And it's free.
And it's free and it's renewable. And so simple little things like that, and not, you know, and just realising that as a little sort of source of information, not getting sucked into the noise on your social feeds and the people who yell really loudly, who sound very persuasive. The reality is, Rosie, that actually renewables in regional Australia, and certainly we know within in a city and, you know, some of the bigger city centres, renewable energy is extremely popular, overwhelmingly popular in regional Australia. Has averaged poll after poll about 70% support for renewables. Slight dip in recent years, understandable given not only some of the, you know, the headwinds and you know, some of the land use conflict, and but certainly the opposition. But renewables are very popular, and we could be forgiven for thinking, oh, there's a lot of opposition to renewables. It sounds like it's actually overwhelming. It's not. And these are the things we need to keep reminding people, these really little touchstones, that these little factoids. Renewables are popular. Solar was invented in Australia. We should be proud of it. That is something to be, you know, have Aussie pride about. You know, how much Aussie pride is there in digging great big holes in the Latrobe Valley and the Upper Hunter, scarring landscapes, dropping water tables, stuffing up agriculture and farming in the process, permanently scarring landscapes. You know, I sort of feel like these are the conversations that we should be having more often. And, you know, this is where you can meet people in the middle. You speak to anyone in regional Australia who's spent any time in a resource extracting region, and they know what it's like to live next door to a coal mine or to a coal seam gas field, or next to a coal-fired power station. It sucks. It is a really unpleasant way to live. And if we continue to have some of those conversations instead of getting sucked into this renewables are ripping up farmland and, it, you know, it's a bait and switch, Rosie. That's some of the things that I think we can meet people in the middle on and say, do we have agreed facts here? When was the last time you drove along the Princess Highway through past your lawn, past Hazelwood, past the Loyangs, and saw into the bottom of those pits? Do you remember the Hazelwood mine fire? Do you remember when the Morwell River broke the banks at your lawn and flooded the coal mine and knocked out the power station, and suddenly Victoria's energy supply was jeopardised? Anyway, that's my rant, Rosie.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, absolutely. And at the same time, though, the people with the most, the you know, these groups with all the money backed by the Centre for Independent Studies, the Institute of Public Affairs, who are, you know, offshoots of the Atlas network, who have a lot of power and a lot of money behind them, and are very, very good at pumping out these messages. So it's a big fight, isn't it? It's a lot to contend with.
And I mean, this is, you know, and I hope this is a bit of a G up and a bit of a spirit lifter in some ways, which is a lot of them talk a bigger game than they've really got. And some of the reason why they need to set up these AstroTurf groups and pretend that they're someone else is because people know, or because they know, that their reputation is mud. They know what they're doing is literally cooking the planet, and that if people really knew who was behind some of these public messaging campaigns, there'd be an uproar. And, you know, the coal industry talks a big game because they know that they are literally, and this is only appropriate, they are facing an extinction crisis, as they should. Coal is in the rearview mirror. All the coal-fired power stations have a closure date. This isn't because there are some sort of, you know, this isn't some hippie climate, you know, boardroom behind the likes of AGL or Energy Australia saying that they want to exit coal because they really care about the planet, it's because the economics are gone.
Yes.
And the same applies for gas. They know that they have a finite amount of time that they can continue to extract, to burn, and to make billions of dollars and wreck the planet in the process, because they know that the curtain is closing for a whole bunch of reasons, both economic, two, because they are literally cooking the planet. And so, you know, what I would like to say in that is, you know, they talk a big game, you know, and have these very big, large, influential industry bodies, and they do have, you know, hundreds of lobbyists that walk the halls of Canberra and various other parliaments around the country. But they're scared. They know they're going to be out of a job soon. It's just how soon we can put them out of a job.
Mm. So I guess our job is to, especially with this Victorian state election coming up, letting our politicians know, especially our Labor government, know that we know what's going on and that we're not going to put up with it, and somehow get our message across over the shouty messages of the likes of Pauline Hanson and the Liberals, etc. And these AstroTurf groups that I seem to be increasing and maybe will continue doing so leading up to the election. Do you think that that's happening? There seem to be more. I've noticed there's a new group called something like Australians for Affordable Energy. Is that a new one? Yep.
Yeah, relatively new, and they're coming thick and fast at the moment, Rosie. And, you know, we know we literally have meme factories pumping out clicks for money in the Philippines, you know, on Meta, and, you know, anyone who's had a chat with their parents at the moment who are spending, an unhealthy amount of time on Facebook, and just literally the sewer that is coming there at the moment. There's a new pop-up AstroTurf group every other day, and, you know, this awful AI slot coming up with, you know, that's often generated out of the US and then just rinsed and repeated over here. So, yeah, we should be really alive to that. We should be having those conversations with our parents and, you know, and just our friends and our community and, you know, just saying, just asking the questions. And, you know, no one likes to be told what to think. You know, it's try and have the conversations with people, just gentle questioning, like, oh, is that true? Are you sure about that? Or, but yes, you know, like the reality is, you know, and the listeners to 3CR and, you know, it's a bit preaching to the converted, and I know, you know, many are pretty smart individuals as it is, but, you know, I get hoodwinked, and it's, you know, it's front organisations like, you know, Australians for Affordable Energy that I look at and I see them in my feed and I think, hang on, who's this? And every now and then, and I shouldn't be saying this too publicly, but they sometimes, and this is what I mean, you know, some of them aren't as smart and as powerful as you think, because they leave telltales and they trip themselves up. And so you can do quick little searches and say, hey, the Australians for Affordable Energy, oh, hang on, but that's registered at the Page Research Centre. Oh, Page Research Centre is the National Party's think tank.
Yes.
Oh, the Page Research Centre was set up by John Anderson, former Deputy Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Oh, so, you know, question everything, have a look at some of the sources. If it sounds a little bit dubious, could well be.
Yep.
There's trusted news sources out there. You know, some of the, you know, the big legacy media still have great journalists working for them. They're still doing great research, great work. But there are, it is a new media landscape. It's a brave new world. And there are indie news sites, you know. There's the True North, who, you know, I really encourage people to go and look at True North, which is aggregating all these wonderful, you know, independent publishers and broadcasters around the country at the moment. You know, the truth is out there, Rosie.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of Denise Revelle or True North before you mentioned it to me the other day. But I think that's I'm going to certainly use that to pass around to people I talk to. You know, when I say to people, there is truth out there, you've just got to find it. But that's an excellent resource. And also you mentioned Dane Pratsky, also known as the Frack Man. Can you, just before we go, can you quickly tell us a little bit about his work?
Yeah, so Frack Man, for those who may have come across him, he literally, the Frack Man came from a documentary he produced in 2015, you know, a guy living in regional New South Wales, and saw the fracking industry come to town and, you know, really saw what was coming, watching them march onto farmers' properties. You know, this is kind of, we're talking the Lock the Gate movement and various others, but up and around Queensland as well. And it basically radicalised him. He was just like, how can this be? How can, you know, these foreign-owned multinational gas companies come in and start drilling holes in my farmland? And that's turned into Frack Man, the documentary, which is, you know, kind of his origin story. And he's out there really questioning things at the moment. You know, he's a tradie, he's on the tools, but, you know, in the evening he's putting together reels and really scratching beneath the surface on these AstroTurf groups and seeing who really is behind the gas and the coal and, you know, some of those lobbies, because he's pissed off. But he's, you know, he's a solid content creator. He works with a lot of other good people and, you know, he communicates with the people who we should all be trying to communicate with, which is, you know, just everyday Australians. And, you know, I really, you know, you just to quickly sort of tie the loop on the Victorian election, where we're all sitting there scratching our heads thinking, how is old Liberal Victoria facing this One Nation tidal wave? And, you know, like, we shouldn't besmirch everyone who's voting One Nation. People are pissed off at the system these days, and they're looking to blow it up, you know. Yeah. And One Nation is their wrecking ball. But, you know, half of Queensland, where One Nation came from, half of Queensland homes have solar on their rooftops. Yeah. This is where you meet people. You have conversations where you meet them where they're at. Yeah. And, you know, there are ways to have those conversations with people. And I think we should be meeting people where they are, you know. So, you know, I think we should all be very alive with the Victorian election. We should not lose heart. We should be engaged in the political process, because as fraught as it may be and as imperfect, it is the only one we've got, and it's a damn sight better than much of the rest of the world.
Yes. Well, you've left me feeling actually quite hopeful and inspired, which is pretty unusual for me. So thank you. And, yeah, I think it's so good that there are all these people and these organisations who are really working hard at spreading the word. And I think you've given us some great advice about how to talk to people and not to give up hope. So that was terrific. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah. Is there anything you wanted to add before you go?
Yeah. Look, we're all allowed to be disenfranchised with the media. We do see the likes of Gina Rinehart buying into Channel 7, into the West media landscape. And, you know, she did try and buy into Fairfax for a while until they kicked her off because she tried to get rid of the editorial independence. But, you know, you do need to continue paying for good journalism. Good journalism doesn't just come out of nowhere. Journalists already get paid a pittance. They get shitty labour. They're doing it not for the money 99% of the time. They're doing it because they're passionate. And good journalism costs money. And so we need to get out of that mindset that you just get this stuff for free. We need to pay people to produce good journalism. It doesn't have to be the big mastheads, but they are still important. You know, but if not, get out and pay some of the independent medias. Go pay people through their Patreons, you know, find them, you know, the Punters Politics, you know, the Michael West medias, you know, even The Guardian, but certainly, you know, The Age and some of the others, you know, they still do good journalism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, engage in the process. And I think I was talking to you offline, Rosie, I understand that, you know, the reality is that, you know, women of, you know, kind of aged above 30 at the moment, around 50% don't watch the news anymore. And I don't blame them, and it's pretty toxic and it can be pretty hard to do it. But find a way that you can engage that doesn't ruin your mental health, but at least has some sort of, you know, input into civic life. Because, you know, we all matter, our opinions matter. Find a way that you can matter.
Great. Okay, thank you so much once again. And I think you're off to Sydney today, are you? Is that right?
In Sydney as we speak.
Oh, okay.
To celebrate the 500,000th cheaper home battery that has gone in around Australia that is now storing people's solar power generated during the day so they can use it at night when power prices are typically highest, and essentially not only taking loads off the grid, but basically making them solar soakers and solar savers and handing the power back over their power bills to the people. So, tick.
Fantastic. So 500,000th, you said?
Yep, in just over 12 months, which just another neat little factoid. We now have more home battery storage throughout Australia deployed in around 13 to 14 months, installed in 13, 14 months, than all of America in total.
Wow.
So we've just basically become one of the world's biggest home battery markets in the world in just over a year.
That is fantastic.
Solar saves money, Rosie.
Absolutely. and on that note, we're going to finish. So thank you once again. And look, the song that we often finish off with on the Climate Action Show is Patti Smith's People Have the Power. And I reckon that's a great one to play straight after this interview.
I think that's perfect. And, yeah, I couldn't have chosen a better artist and a better track myself. So thank you so much for having me, Rosie.
No worries. Thanks a lot. Bye, Tim.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Climate Action Show on 3CR 855 AM and Radio Skid Row. Thank you for tuning in to another episode. We will get to People Have the Power by Patti Smith, but before that, I just want to say thank you again to Gavin from the Australian Conservation Foundation and Tim from the Smart Energy Council for coming on the show, and also to Rosie for her interview. If you want more information about anything we have talked about on the show today, you can head to 3cr.org.au/climateaction. We will be back next Monday at 5 p.m. and up next is Breadline, so please stay tuned.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.